I'm Carol Coletta, and this is Smart City. For the past 50 years, development in America has been sprawling away from the old urban cores into ever farther suburbs and exurbs. Why did it happen? Our guests today have some answers. Anthony Flint is author of This Land, The Battle Over Sprawl and the Future of America. It's a history of modern development in our nation and a call for a national conversation about how the country should grow. Diana Dilloway explores how development decisions affected one American city, Buffalo, New York. It's a chronicle of local misfires, misdirection, and missed opportunities. Our subject is sprawl and development today on Smart City. But first, the news. I'm Carol Coletta, and you're listening to Smart City. Anthony Flint is author of This Land, The Battle Over Sprawl and the Future of America. He's a veteran journalist who covered planning, development, and housing for the Boston Globe for 16 years and was a visiting scholar in 2005 at the Harvard Design School. Anthony, do you consider sprawl a pejorative term?
Well, we've been spreading ourselves pretty thinly across the landscape for the last half century, and it's just become a very dysfunctional pattern for development and how to live. So it's pejorative in the sense that it doesn't work very well. It's not very practical, and it's not the bargain, I think, that people think it's cracked up to be. When you factor in transportation and energy costs of driving out to the single-family subdivision, an hour from your workplace, filling up the tank, of course, is a lot more expensive these days. So I think it's turned out to be a pattern that has just been a little disappointing in terms of how convenient and cost-effective it is.
Why did it occur? Why did we spread ourselves so thinly?
Well, in the book, I talk about a number of factors, some of them cultural and historical, and has to do with who we are in America and Jefferson's idea of everybody having their own piece of land to cultivate. I think some of that is at work. A lot of it is a sense of safety and security, good schools, elbow room, all of those reasons. But a big driver is also this idea of convenience and the quest for a better quality of life. And I think that's where we've gone astray. It was also the dispersed suburban development pattern was also, of course, supported by government policies, some directly, some indirectly. The interstate highway system, which, of course, enables sprawl and the continued road building that we see funded by the federal government, and low-cost mortgages, urban renewal, a lot of factors that unfortunately had a negative impact on our cities and promoted this kind of suburban development.
But was there a golden moment when it all made sense?
Well, the 50s, I think, was a time when people were looking for a house they could afford, just as they do now. And you had those suburban developments that like Levittown and others, that provided shelter, provided a little lawn and a place for kids to play. And the suburban ideal is legitimate. I actually find it perfectly rational that people would move to some of these single-family subdivisions. It's mostly because that's where they can find a single-family home that they can afford. So it's really affordability that's making sprawl so popular to this day.
Do you think the affordability question or attribute can be delivered closer in? I mean, is there a way to put that formula together?
That is the central challenge of the smart growth movement, I think, is how to maintain affordability and economic diversity and other kinds of diversity. I was just in the Pacific Northwest, and a place like Seattle, I heard a lot of folks say, hey, I would love to live in the city, but I can't afford it. The condo towers in Belltown on the waterfront, the single-family homes that are sort of snapped up by Microsoft executives wanting to live in the city and close to all those amenities is really making it hard for middle-class families to move into some of these urban neighborhoods. But I have always argued that if there were more of these urban neighborhoods, if there were more new urbanist developments and revitalized cities, more to choose from, then they would be less expensive as a matter of supply and demand. Right now, of course, sprawl is ubiquitous, and I think the hope of the smart growth movement is that cities and urban neighborhoods and older suburbs will become more ubiquitous and thus a little bit less of a premium on them. They won't be so expensive.
You've raised the issue of choice, and of course that is a common argument for sprawl. That's what people are choosing. That's the marketplace at work. Do you agree with that reasoning?
Well, I think it's a little like saying that Americans love cornflakes for cereal when the only thing that's stocked in the aisle is Frosted Flakes. Really, there hasn't been a lot of choice in terms of affordability, in terms of what's available, and in terms of what's been built and where our investments have gone. And, of course, what the zoning and other rules of development favor. So it's really been corralled into this idea of dispersed, separated use, car-dependent development, homes in one place, stores in another, workplaces in yet another. And it's really the smart growth movement is what's offering more choice, to my mind, expanding housing choice, different types of housing for different stages of life, for people who are retiring, young people, families. There's actually more choice in what smart growth has to offer in terms of housing and how to live than I think what we've been offered by sprawl.
Help me understand where smart growth and new urbanism intersect or overlap.
Well, they're really two wings of the same bird, if you will. Smart growth is focused a little bit more on policy and government initiatives, mostly incentives, by the way, these days, rather than restrictions, rather than saying, here's a map, here's where you can develop, here's where you can't. Urban growth boundaries and those types of restrictions. Less emphasis on that now and more on incentives to change zoning, to build more densely, to allow developers to go into urban infill parcels and develop old factory sites and the like. So government's role in that area is to tee up that kind of development and make it possible. The new urbanists are more concerned with the design of what's built, the design of the neighborhood, although they also have been getting into writing new zoning codes, which sounds terribly boring, but it's actually incredibly important. They have a smart code and other so-called form-based codes. It's a new approach to zoning that brings about traditional neighborhoods and a range of human habitation that is more in line with what we used to build in this country before World War II. So the new urbanists are the architects, and they're concerned with the design of the neighborhood. They're also getting into a policy a little bit, but the smart growth movement is more concerned with government policy at a little bit of a higher level to make this kind of new style of development possible.
You've raised two or three questions I want to follow up on. One is the form-based codes. Describe that in a way a layperson, really not interested in zoning codes, but interested in what his or her community looks like and how it functions. Describe what those codes do.
Well, you have to go back to the turn of the last century when zoning was, you know, first came into being. It was based on the principle of separated use because you had to make sure that the slaughterhouse wasn't anywhere near the homes or near the pubs and so forth. That really guaranteed dispersal and separated use, this idea of all residential and commercial and workplace zones and industrial zones being strictly segregated. Now the idea is, well, we've got a new knowledge-based economy, times have changed, and we want to mix some of those uses together, jumble them together in town centers and downtowns. But the zoning code doesn't allow it. So what the form-based code does is makes it possible to concentrate on the configuration of buildings and their size and design and massing, and is less concerned with what goes on inside the building, the use, in other words. So it's an entirely new approach. It isn't obsessed with this idea of, well, we got to make sure that some office or retail function isn't cheek by jowl with residential use, because now the idea is to mix all those together. The other thing that the form-based code does is provides for a range of human habitation from the urban to the rural. It's based on something called the transect, which divides our zones of living up into six different ranges of density. And that, too, is a new approach to how we live and how we function in the physical environment that we build for ourselves.
And where does sprawl or typical American suburban development fit on the transect?
Well, it's a range. So it really goes from an urban neighborhood and a downtown in a major city to a suburb, a first ring or older suburb, typically. These are some of the suburbs that were built in the 50s and 60s, and actually that people are just now rediscovering, to a more rural and agricultural-based zone all the way at the other end of the transect. What's missing is what we have now, which is this exurban, beyond the periphery suburban development, where you have subdivisions just spread across the land and strip malls and office parks. The transect doesn't accommodate for that. Rather, it's a more straightforward gradation from the urban to the suburban, as seen in the sort of classic close-in 50s and 60s style suburb, and then to the rural.
Mm-hmm. You're listening to Smart City. Our guest is Anthony Flint. He is author of This Land, The Battle Over Sprawl and the Future of America. Two questions about new urbanism. One, it is often criticized because it is often practiced in green fields. In other words, you take a piece of land that may very well be exurban and you develop it. Yes, you develop it in a different way. You develop it with some sort of town center in a walkable fashion. But chances are, nobody is going to be walking out of that exurban neighborhood to do serious shopping, to go to the office. So it's still very car dependent, and many of them are very far away from the developed urban centers. How do you respond to that criticism?
Well, they do quite a bit of infill work, what's known as infill, that is going into an established city, and large or small, and taking a piece of land that's closer in and is by existing infrastructure, including public transportation. So they do, I think it's a little under half of their work is actually in those kinds of environments. A place like Harbortown in Memphis is a good example. But they do suburban developments, and that's what they've been famous for, if you will, the Kentlands, Seaside in Florida. And these are places that are traditional town design and traditional neighborhoods, but yes, they are sort of unto themselves, and they aren't the perfect marriage of that kind of neighborhood design and access to transit, for example. But they're getting to be. This is very much on the minds of new urbanist planners. They don't want it to be car dependent, but even if you look at these neighborhoods as self-contained areas, the fact is people don't have to use their car as much getting around, going walking to the corner store to get a half gallon of milk. You don't have to hop in the car for every single errand. Of course, 80% of our car trips are for errands and are only just a couple of miles, but it's required that we hop in the car when we live in these dispersed suburban environments. So they have their advantages, and their argument is that, look, suburban development is over 90% of the development that occurs in this country. We ought to get a piece of that action. We ought to be out front providing alternatives to the separated use, exurban sprawl, and if it's in the suburbs, so be it. Let's dip our toe in the water and see if people like these kinds of neighborhoods. And they do. In fact, they become too popular. They become very expensive very fast.
Mm-hmm. That is an interesting market phenomenon. When you offer the choice of these kinds of neighborhoods, the price goes up really quickly, which is simply a reflection of the market.
Yes, what they've discovered and what the many developers have discovered is that urbanism is an amenity. It adds value. It's an amenity like a golf course used to be in a retirement community in Florida. If you think of it that way, access to a walkable environment with access to stores and the other functions of life don't require a car to get around. This all adds value to a neighborhood. And the realtors recognize this as well. I was at a smart growth conference in Denver, and the National Association of Realtors was there handing out pedometers, those devices that measure how many steps you take. And I thought that was quite significant. They're really jumping on this trend and realizing how people want shorter commutes. They want to be able to walk. And they'll pay to be involved in that.
How things age is not always easily predicted, and now we're beginning to see, of course, some of the older suburbs beginning to age poorly, and some researchers have even suggested that that's going to be the new big problem for cities is how to deal with these older suburbs.
Yes, they do need help. They need investment. They need reinvestment and infrastructure and kind of a retrofitting process that includes planning for transportation and making a little bit more density around nodes in a transportation corridor. All of it very hard work, not impossible. And in fact, these older suburbs is where you're going to find that affordability we were talking about earlier. But yes, it's hard to predict, and that's what makes all of this topic so complex and fascinating. It's hard work. There is a suspicion, I think, of planning and planners because we have gone through many other iterations of what was going to be the great hope, like urban renewal. And so I think people are skeptical. Now, of course, the easiest thing to do is sprawl because that doesn't take any thought or planning. That, however, is what has given us the landscape that we see today. So I was really drawn to the smart growth movement and the new urbanist movement because it teed itself up to do that kind of hard work. I think that they have their flaws, but they're really trying to change the way we build on the land and create more functional communities. And so I think that's worth it.
What do you hope people will take away from reading your book?
Well, I wind up, it's a collection of stories. I tried to make it very much for a general audience. It tells the story of the smart growth movement, of green building, of new urbanism. And it also tells the story about the other side, property rights, and some of the backlash against these new ideas. And the way we're engaged in pitched battles that have to do with race and class and safety. Safe growth is a big part of the book as well in the rebuilding process for the Gulf Coast. But I do conclude with a couple of recommendations for how we can take stock and change the way we're building on the land. One thing to do is to make an assessment, an honest assessment of what our needs are. How much house do we need? Is it really that convenient and cost-effective to be that far from the workplace? Do we like the amenities that an urban neighborhood can provide, whether it's parks or being able to walk to the corner store? I then call on government to change zoning and make it possible for alternatives to sprawl to happen. Right now, a lot of the zoning codes and building codes and red tape is actually a barrier to urban redevelopment and retrofitting older suburbs. So I think there's going to be a real shift in demand. I think as gas prices go up, people are going to be turning away from sprawl. And so I think it's government's obligation to be ready for that and make sure that the rules and subsidies and investments are lined up to provide that alternative. So those are some of the recommendations that I make for a more hopeful future.
Do you see any signs that rising gas prices indeed are changing behavior?
Well, when it first started to happen, and by the way, they're never going back down again, in my view, a lot of talk about technology and conservation. hydrogen hybrid cars and so forth. That's all terrific, but there's one thing that technology is not going to do, I believe, and that's make energy cheap again. So we're in a new era, and I think people are very fast to adapt to that. The American consumer is very smart. They're watching the budget. They're seeing the hit that filling up the tank is making on the family budget and changing accordingly. The developers, I think, have long since figured this out. They're building urban villages on closed airfields and failed shopping malls across the country because I think they're anticipating. They're no dummies. They're anticipating this shift in demand. There was surveys done when the gas prices first went up, suggested people wanted to take transit more and they wanted to walk more. But for millions of Americans, there's no transit to take and nothing to walk to because the physical arrangements we've made for ourselves in this country was predicated on cheap energy. And it is dispersed and spread out and requires driving everywhere. Another final piece I think that is becoming more of a factor is awareness about global warming. Each of us puts 26 tons of carbon into the atmosphere every year. That's primarily through driving. And we drive around because of our physical environment. So changing the way we live out of that environmental sensitivity, I think increasingly might become a little bit of a factor as well.
You may have seen the story recently in the Wall Street Journal that said the demand for McMansions is on the decline. Do you see any evidence of that?
Yes. And it's a range of house sizes. The particular couple that the Wall Street Journal focused on, I think it was a 5,000-square-foot home. That's a little on the big side, but the fellow who was quoted was almost hapless or sheepish, as he said, you know, I'm not sure why we did this in the first place. And I think that is happening all across America, particularly as it's getting more expensive to heat and cool a 3,000-square-foot home. And, of course, the reliance on the car to get around. Yes, I think that there is a sort of a right-sizing trend that's going on in the country as people make that assessment about what their needs really are and what they really derive out in terms of satisfaction out of life, whether it's more urban amenities or a great big house.
Anthony Flint is author of This Land, The Battle Over Sprawl and the Future of America. Anthony, thanks for being with us on Smart City.
Thank you.
After a short break, we'll return to talk to Diana Dillaway about a failure of power in one American city. And we'll talk to Otis White about the disappearance of corporate CEOs in civic affairs. Smart City is made possible in part by the support of Memphis Urban Innovators, a collaboration of Memphis business leaders, including the Memphis Regional Chamber, who are focused on bringing smart people, smart ideas, and smart solutions to Memphis and the new economy. You're listening to Smart City. You're listening to Smart City. I'm Carol Coletta. Otis White runs Civic Strategies in Atlanta, and each week he brings us urban insights from around the country. Otis, we've often talked about the disappearance of business leaders and civic affairs, but you found at least one company that's bucking the trend.
Yeah, and it's a surprising one. This is a very familiar company for most people. It's IBM. Now, IBM seems to have all the excuses for being just like a lot of big corporations these days and distancing itself from involvement in things like Chambers of Commerce and United Way campaigns. But that really isn't the case. It is not a company that is deeply connected to any one community, but it seems to have decided that it's in its corporate interest to connect to all of the places that it has significant investments in. And it has identified 23 metro areas in the country that it wants to be involved in. It has more than 50 of its executives involved on United Way boards, more than 36 involved on Chamber of Commerce boards. And it's going about this thing very, very methodically. The real question sort of isn't how you do this, because IBM certainly shows how you do it. But the real question is, why would IBM do this? And that's a little bit of a mystery. They say it's part of their corporate culture, but they also have figured out that somehow this helps them in their business connections as well. So this is really an encouraging thing, Carol. We don't see many companies stepping up the way that IBM does, and for that, we should be thankful.
Well, it is encouraging. Let me ask you this, though. Are they ascending from board membership to board leadership? Because you and I both know you can languish on a board for a very long time and not really play a leadership role.
Well, it depends on the individual. But yes, there are, apparently are some of these IBM business unit executives who have taken some real leadership positions in these communities, from Atlanta to Los Angeles to Burlington, Vermont. They've really been behind some important community initiatives. And again, that's very unusual these days.
Well, good for IBM. Otis, we'll talk to you next week.
Thanks, Carol.
Otis White is a regular columnist for Governing Magazine. You're listening to Smart City. I'm Carol Coletta. Diana Dilloway is author of Power Failure, Politics, Patronage, and the Economic Failure of Buffalo, New York. She is a native of Buffalo, grew up there, but has worked for more than 25 years in California on urban and economic development. Diana, in your book, you explore the sources of power in Buffalo and how power has been used for good and bad. What did you find?
Well, I found a number of things. First of all, I really discovered that in order for a leader or a city's leadership to be effective, there has to be close attention paid to the structure of power and the planning process, those two elements. What I found in Buffalo is that the structure of power included a number of people and a certain element of the community, but not all the community. Really, I think for the power structure to be effective, it has to include all the different parties. Now, it doesn't mean that everybody is going to be involved at all times, but there has to be a way for the communities and the neighborhoods, their ideas and their leadership to be included and the ideas to bubble up to some final authority that will make some decisions effectively. The planning process I also found to be the other critical element. I think that the planning process has to be ongoing.
The magnitude of the job losses suffered in Buffalo was astonishing. 70,000 jobs in steel and related industries alone in the 14 years between 1970 and 1984.
Right.
What led to those losses?
Well, there were a number of things. The steel industry had tremendous losses during those years. But there were about five factors of decline. And those factors begin with transportation. It really goes back as far as 1910. Buffalo was a tremendous port of transshipment. And during the end of the 19th century and up into the, say, middle 20th century, you had raw materials coming along the Great Lakes, coming to Buffalo. And there they would be reprocessed, such things as grains from the Midwest, iron ore for steel, and they would be and leather for tanning, and they would be transformed there in reprocessing centers and then sent out to markets from there. With the opening of the Panama Canal, for instance, you had the first kind of little bit of decline. That was in 1910. It turned out it was a cheaper way to ship goods, raw materials, to markets around through the Panama Canal rather than the rising transfer costs in Buffalo. Then you had in 1959 the opening of the St. Lawrence Seaway. And the St. Lawrence Seaway, Buffalo was bypassed because you had the Welland Canal. As the ships traveled east along Lake Erie, it went north through the Welland Canal rather than to Buffalo as previously, and then up through the St. Lawrence Seaway. That happened in 1959. And so at the same time, you had in the late 50s, an undercapacity of steel. And at that point, Buffalo was one of the third largest steel maker in the United States. But they had old systems rather than the basic oxygen furnace systems that Japan and Germany put online. And so they had obsolete buildings. You had an undercapacity and then an overcapacity of steel when you had all the new players from the East coming on. And so Buffalo's Bethlehem Steel and Republic Steel and the other big factories decided that it would be easier just to close down. And over from 1971 to 83, you had a complete shift and closure. And then the linkage industries, automobiles and others, they also were affected by the losses there. Then you also had absentee management. In Buffalo, unfortunately, a lot of the home-owned industries had been sold or bought out. You know, when you don't have the ownership in the city, you don't have collaboration among the leaders. And that made really affected the leadership in Buffalo quite negatively, because you had decisions being taken outside the city that would affect development in town. And then you had the labor. You had militant unions, and you had the high wages, which increased 47% over 10 years in the 70s, between 70 and 80. That affected steel and other industries negatively. And finally, you had competing realms of influence. You had so many, 80 or 90 different agencies and authorities in Buffalo, all working on development in a two-county region. And that none of that really worked well in terms of putting together final plans for Buffalo.
Was there or could there have been an effective replacement strategy for that many jobs lost?
Well, very difficult, because there was somewhat of a replacement, but they were all service sector jobs. And, of course, as you know, they don't pay very well. The wages in steel and all the heavy industry in Buffalo really created a fabulous middle class in Buffalo and bolstered the neighborhoods to such a degree, frankly, that most of Buffalo's ethnic communities and WASP community, the elite business community, none of them really wanted change. They really wanted to support status quo.
What made them think, Diana, that they could in fact maintain the status quo when some of the factors of decline or impending decline were so obvious?
Well, that's a good question. I was there for a lot of it. You know, we would talk peripherally about the closure, let's say, of the factories or the movement of factories out of the city or different businesses or the opening of the canal of the St. Lawrence Seaway. I think we were all so just involved in our lives and the joy of our very strong neighborhoods that we somehow we'd never thought that it would come to what it has come to, a decline of population from nearly 600,000 people to about 350,000 people now, and it looks like they're still losing. So, you know, the ethnic communities, the Irish, the Polish, the Italian, and the different sections of the city, life revolved very happily around the neighborhood parish, the neighborhood schools, and the patronage system, which you all, you know, other cities like Chicago, for instance, you know, they when one group's mayor comes into office, there are plenty of jobs and other remunerations that come along that make, you know, that seem to make everything work just fine. So I think that things evolved slowly. It didn't happen overnight. And when all was said and done, it was hard to believe. And then there we were, kind of holding an empty basket.
It's interesting you mentioned earlier that you faulted the process of planning and the structure of power in Buffalo for not being inclusive. And yet you talk about the people in the neighborhoods, the ethnic neighborhoods, the middle class, being very content with life as they knew it. Wouldn't that make it difficult to get them involved in planning? And two, the mayor, the business leadership, I mean, people who could see the signs of what was happening, why didn't they act?
Well, they had plenty of studies showing, really outlining what was happening. And the business leaders predominantly and the mayors who went along with the leader, with the business leadership, chose to ignore some of the suggestions. It's hard to say why they would have done it, but I think that they, as I said before, they felt that things would kind of right themselves. They never thought the steel industry would leave, and that meant the linkage industries would remain there. But the other point I want to make is most cities, when they're working on revitalization downtown or an industrial strategy, most of them have a very strong business organization. Buffalo didn't have such an organization. They did have one in name. But in most cases, on most of the most important debates and issues as to, for instance, where a new campus for the State University of New York would be located, either downtown or out in the suburbs, they declined to even take a position on it. In another instance, the rapid transit system that was to be built, they also did not take a position at all as to what could be done when there were delays. A strong leadership organization could have worked through collaboration to make things come together and avoid some of the delays. Buffalo just did not have that kind of leadership. And then, as a result of that, it allowed a couple of individual leaders, very powerful people, to work there in their own interest around the periphery. And then in that case, you do not end up with maybe the best outcomes. And we now have a university outside, 13 miles outside the city, and with 10 to 15,000 students that could have been downtown. Urban renewal had already cleared the land. The land on the waterfront was clear. Governor Rockefeller back in the 60s would have ensured that all the funding was there, and actually it was. It ended up being there for the university, but way out in the town of Amherst. And so without the strong leadership organization to work with a strong mayor, you end up with a lot of ad hoc planning, and that is not very effective.
You're listening to Smart City. Our guest is Diana Dilloway. She is author of Power Failure, Politics, Patronage, and the Economic Failure of Buffalo, New York. You talked about the SUNY campus and its location. You talked about the failure to build the rapid rail line. There are two other events that you focus on in your book, the location of the convention center and the location of the football stadium. Now, I'm trying to understand, in your opinion, from your 8 years of research, did you determine that there was a desire and a belief that downtown could be kept as it was? Or do you think there was really some intent to force downtown into decline or to develop real estate in other parts of the region? What was really going on there? Because as you say, the city did have a business organization, but it failed to take a position on some very key issues.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think it was two of the three points that you made. The first is, I think that there were some of the very powerful leaders who just did not want change downtown. It was just as simple as that. They had a very powerful voice, as I say, outside the business organization that was supposed to be the development foundation.
Diana, let me interrupt. Were you able to interview those people?
Yes, I did.
And when you did they admit to you that they thought they could keep downtown as it was?
Yes. They really did think so, but they didn't realize what the fallout would be. I think that's the critical thing. The other point that you brought up, you know, real estate outside the city would be ultimately more valuable than the real estate down in an area that had been cleared for urban renewal in terms of long-term development and building. I mean, in effect, a whole new big city was built as a result of the university going outside Buffalo's jurisdiction. Amherst was always an ongoing and very attractive area, but where the university was built was really on swampland that was very undesirable, but you have built up all around it all kinds of suburbs and hotels and all kinds, all the things that you would expect to find around a university and all the services. Another thing that I think all of us in Buffalo didn't stop to think about is what the university, of course, has to offer the city and what the city has to offer the university in terms of all of the culture and the beautiful architecture that Buffalo does have. Mm-hmm. It was really a great loss on both sides. As far as a stadium goes, a football stadium is never going to cure the ills of a downtown. It is not a redevelopment tool, really, or an economic development tool. But it does bring people downtown. It creates a denser downtown, and that's all very good for a city.
For many of the years you studied, Buffalo had two competing newspapers. In your judgment, did that benefit the city, or was it not a factor in the city's development?
Oh, having competing newspapers was terrific. One newspaper was the oldest, was quite conservative, Republican, and always took the elite position. It had been owned by the same family for over 100 years. The other paper took the position more of the ethnic communities, the Democratic machine. So you had a very good debate going on. But the interesting thing I found is, and of course I am never in favor of just a one newspaper town. In this case, when the Buffalo News was bought out by Warren Buffett, it really kind of opened the paper up. This was the more conservative of the two. And the 100 years of kind of control of a very powerful family, that was lost. The Gordian knot, really, of power in some respects had been cut at that point. And really the paper, even though it is the only paper in town, has opened up more to community interests, and especially and the Black community as well, that, you know, could take a position in political ways, either on one side or the other. It really did open up things quite a bit. So In this respect, it wasn't all bad.
You quote Jane Jacobs as saying, subsidies are transactions of decline. Do you believe that's true in every case?
No, not in every case. I think subsidies can be incredibly helpful. The problem, at least in this case, and I think it is kind of a tendency, is once a city or a company gets used to these subsidies, or an investor, I should say, then it's hard to kind of cut them off. And then when they, in fact, do come to an end, then, the company is left perhaps without the private investment that they might otherwise have gotten. So, no, I think subsidies, and in the case for Buffalo, it never could have gotten through some of the darkest days, for instance, around 1975, when the city was days away from bankruptcy. Subsidies were incredibly important. The thing is, they have to be accompanied by private investment. And I think in Buffalo's case, this was not always what happened.
Isn't Buffalo's story the story of many regions, a city built on one great strength, in Buffalo's case, transportation, which then suffers a reversal of fortune when that strength is no longer relevant, and yet it clings to its past long after it makes sense?
Right. And I think that's been a big, big part of the problem. You know, going back, one of the reasons I really wanted to write about Buffalo is that I never could see that they had a real vision or a plan, through all the years of the decline, and then as they were trying to get up after the worst of the decline. And I think that that's perhaps some of the problem today. if they could re-envision themselves as a smaller city, I think, and one, and I know that one of their strategies is to work with, Roswell Park, and they have a medical strategy, and they have quite a complex of medical activities that are going on in Buffalo. If they can focus on that, and if maybe a couple of others, such as maybe historic and cultural things in the city, then maybe they will be able to re-envision and reenact, you know, and make it a city that, that they can be proud of.
What can be done, in your opinion, Diana, to make places more resilient, better able to anticipate and recognize change and then get ahead of it?
Mm. That's a good question. To be able to just look the facts in the face and discuss it, debate it, put together plans that they could alter if they find they don't work. You know, ideas and plans are not written in stone. So, all right, try a new idea. And after 5 years, it's not working or it's not coming out the way one or the city would like, then change that plan. But move ahead with a plan. In the case of Buffalo, I hate to say it, I think that there has not been a focus on some innovative plans. And then saying, all right, if this plan doesn't work, we will revamp it. But that takes a certain attitude that is willing to look the facts in the face and take a risk.
Diana Dillaway is author of Power Failure, Politics, Patronage, and the Economic Failure of Buffalo, New York. Diana, thanks for being with us on Smart City.
Thank you.
You're listening to Smart City. I'm Carol Coletta. The pursuit of happiness is such a part of the American way. It's included in the Declaration of Independence. But CityView's commentator Walker Smith suggests that a bigger paycheck may not get you there.
Near the end of his new book, Stumbling on Happiness, Harvard psychology professor Daniel Gilbert offers an interesting explanation for why we believe that money brings happiness, even though it most certainly does not. Sorry to drop that bombshell on you, but decades of research show quite definitively that money has no correlation with happiness, above a certain threshold, that is, although a threshold that is quite modest. For people in abject poverty, more money matters a lot, yet only up to a point, a threshold variously calculated to be as little as $20,000 a year or less. Above this threshold, people with more money are no happier than people with less. This is true of nations as well. Above this threshold, the average measured happiness of people in rich nations is no greater than that of people in poorer nations. Indeed, happiness is a funny thing. People suffering from serious diseases or injuries are typically no less happy than they were before, and lottery winners are typically no more happy than before. Yet we typically predict exactly the opposite. We are just not very good at predicting what will make us happy or at correcting our misjudgments. So why can't we stop ourselves from being taken in by the illusion that more money brings greater happiness? Professor Gilbert argues that mistaken notions of all sorts continue to be believed because they are essential for the survival of the things that do make us happy. While earning more doesn't make us happier, the work entailed keeps the wheels of commerce turning, which enables us to maintain the sort of stable society that brings happiness to people of all incomes. Absent a stable society, there would be chaos and poverty, and everyone would be unhappy. So we simply must believe that money brings happiness. Otherwise, we would stop working, which would eventually be to our detriment. Professor Gilbert refers to beliefs like this as quote-unquote self-replicating because they motivate people to do the things truly necessary for happiness, thus keeping these beliefs alive even though the beliefs are incorrect. But we should be smarter than this, because if we let this belief go too far, we wind up with less happiness. In his 2000 book, The Loss of Happiness in Market Democracies, emeritus Yale political scientist Robert Lane reviewed all of the available research and concluded that time spent accumulating more stuff took away from time spent with others, the number one correlate of happiness. So it's essential that we strike a balance. We can't drop out, but we should take more time for ourselves and for others. Maybe the French students who took to the streets protesting laws threatening job security weren't completely off base. Sure, unemployment in France is in double digits, and its economy is not among the most competitive. But France has mandated a shorter work week, and its worker productivity exceeds the U.S., Britain, Germany, and Japan. Many Americans covet a French quality of life. Not that France has perfected the ideal balance, but perhaps we too should make balance a bigger priority. For City Views, this is Walker Smith.
Walker Smith is president of Yankelovich. He comes to us from Georgia Public Radio in Atlanta. Join us online at smartcityradio.com to listen to archive shows, sign up for our podcast, and register for our weekly newsletter. Smart City's web content and audio archive are supported by CEOs for Cities, a national network of urban leaders working to speed innovation in cities. Information at ceosforcities.org. National distribution is made possible by the Hyde Family Foundations, investing in programs that generate lasting change to improve the future of Memphis, Tennessee, and its citizens. For more information, visit hydefoundations.org. Eric Rudd is our co-producer and engineer. I'm Carol Coletta.